Well, welcome back on this Wednesday in Tucson, and today we are going to take on a topic that I have spent a majority of my life working on, homelessness. Back in the 80s, many decades ago, I was a realtor, worked for Tucson Realty and Trust, realty execs, did a lot of development projects. The Sheraton, it was the Sheraton El Conquistador back then, and as a member of the Tucson Board of Realtors, we started a foundation, the Hearth Foundation, and they founded a homeless shelter. And I reached out this morning and to see, I believe New Beginnings is still up and operating in Arizona. It would make it 36 years old. It took primarily women and children off the streets. And it allowed the women to transition and to rehabilitate and get jobs. And it was very successful. And about 10, 15 years ago, they expanded to veterans' families. As we know, we have a serious problem in Pima County for homelessness. And so I invited one of my good friends and experts in this area, Jeff Taylor. And Jeff, I want to just thank you for taking the time to be with my listeners and be with us in Pima County this morning.
Thank you, Kathleen. I'm honored to be here.
I would love it if you would kind of let people know what your journey is in terms of homelessness. I think we'll soon see that there's substance abuse involved, that there's a lot of issues, that it's not a simple problem. It's a complex problem. And I'd like my listeners to kind of know your journey and how you and I have come to work together. So if you could just start introducing yourself to the people that are listening this morning, and then we'll go from there.
I think it's important to note, you know, for at least this discussion this morning, is that we need to define the subpopulations of homelessness, and because they're very different. So for today's discussion, we won't be talking about the elderly. There's a huge problem, you know, that's coming upon us and has come upon us since our rents have been increasing much more here in Arizona than other parts of the country. So if you're an elderly person on a fixed income, then the rents are really outpacing the increases in your, let's say, Social Security.
The affordable housing issues.
Exactly, and they're getting priced out. And not only just affordable housing, they're just getting priced out of regular housing. So we're not going to discuss that population, although important. Then we have families that are homeless where something happened. There was maybe a health issue where, you know, the father and mother or both were unable to continue their employment. Their income was affected or some other family emergency. And that is another population, families that are homeless, that is very important, but not really part of our discussion today. What we'll at least all be addressing is chronic homelessness. Chronic homelessness has a definition, but basically I like to really kind of, you know, make it as simple as possible. And those are the encampments that you see that are expanding, not only in Tucson, all of Pima County, also up here in Maricopa County. And so those are the more visibly homeless individuals. They are really, we have to redefine what chronic homelessness is and call it what it really is. And what it really is untreated drug addiction, untreated mental illness, or some combination of both. And that makes up the lion's share, the super majority of the homeless population.
Well, and Jeff, to your point, I drive from where I live to come to the station, and there's a wash on Speedway Boulevard. It's Midtown, and there's a homeless encampment there. And I believe the city has estimated that there's more than 1,600 people living on the streets in Tucson, but we have this huge encampment right in the center part of town. So you're absolutely correct in stating that. So continue.
So that's what, you know, we'll be discussing this morning, Kathleen, are the chronically homeless. So just to kind of qualify for everyone, I grew up here in Arizona. I was born in Tucson at TMC and really went to grade school and high school in Phoenix. My father worked for the Coca-Cola Bottling Company, and so he was in Tucson and then was transferred up to Phoenix. And great family. You know, it was kind of a mixed family, Brady Bunch family. My birth mother and father were divorced when I was five, and my mother moved to San Diego, and my father lived in Phoenix, and so I was shuttled back and forth. And they really kind of co-parented myself and my brother, and then my father remarried when I was 10 years old and into a large family. And so now we were a family of six, and I was the youngest of the six. And the, you know, upbringing that I received is unusual for someone who ended up the way I ended up. So went to high school, got into sports, and was injured once I was actually back to the high school career. You know, I got some size. I'm 6'4" and got some speed, and therefore was being recruited by a lot of different colleges throughout the United States for, you know, NCAA football, and ended up playing for the University of Arizona, where I was injured as a sophomore. And I was given narcotic pain medication. It was a pretty severe injury, like many other football players, a knee injury. I'd never been injured before. Mm-hmm. It was a career-ending injury, and I was prescribed narcotic pain medication. Now, this was several decades ago. We didn't know a lot about, you know, the dangers of opioid medications back then. We know a lot about it now. Yes. Because of what's occurring in our communities. We didn't really know a lot about it then. So here I am, a sophomore, big campus, on crutches, falling behind in school because I had the surgery, and I have a lot of anxiety over that. Like, am I going to be able to continue in school without playing football? Am I going to be able to keep up with my classes? And just, you know, the transportation issues. I was in a leg cast, which basically back then it was a cast that had your legs sticking out straight. You couldn't hardly get in a car. You know, it was kind of
hard to pick up girls on the college campus, or maybe it was easier. I don't know about that.
Or maybe, you know, go the sympathy route, who knows. But I did come up with a contraption. So I took one of the cranks off of my bicycle, and I would lay my injured leg onto the pedal, you know, all the way down, extended down. And then I would scoot myself along the curb like a skateboard. You know, and so that's how I got around campus. But so I'm experiencing anxiety and also a lot of pain from this injury and the surgery. So I take this narcotic, and it worked great for physical pain, but it also worked really well for this anxiety. So really the first mind-altering substance I have any experience with was prescribed to me by a doctor. So I remember thinking that whatever's in this pill really works for me. Now, I happened to dodge the addictive route at that point, but it was parked in my brain that, you know, that this opiate medication really gave me what is called a false sense of well-being. Nothing in my life changed. You know, I still had, you know,
a broken leg.
The leg and the falling behind in school, and financially, am I going to be able to stay in school? Now, nothing changed there except that narcotic hit my bloodstream and gave me that false sense of really well-being.
Hey, Jeff, so we will have to continue this right after this break. I have to have breaks, and unfortunately I didn't want to take it right now, but we will come back. I have Jeff Taylor, a government relations specialist, on my show today talking about drug addiction, the homelessness, and many other topics. Thank you. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Wynn Tucson. I'm Kathleen Wynn with our special guest today, Jeff Taylor, who's a government relations professional. Jeff, so we have you in college, and you've taken your first pain medication, and it left a feeling that nothing like you'd ever experienced. And so please continue with our listeners about the story, and we'll get into our main topic today.
Certainly. So I made it through school, and my senior year I was hired. I was a finance major, and I was hired by a very prestigious stock brokerage firm, Wall Street firm, the oldest firm in Arizona, and then kind of thrown into the shark pit of Wall Street trading. So I became what's called a stock options trader, and had several career and personal successes over the next 9 years, kind of a type A personality, and took one vacation in 9 years, always working, always there for the opening bell, would always leave, and had some great mentors there and had a very successful career to the point when I was 29, the market had basically crashed in October of 1987, really dating myself here. And that
I'm right there with you,
dropped.
So don't put a lot of spotlight on that, okay?
So the market lost 22% of its value in a period of about 2.5 hours. Mm. It was the largest loss of wealth that this nation had ever seen, and I happened to be 100% short the market at that time. Mm. And so in that single trading day, I made more money for myself and my clients than I had in the prior several years of trading. And it was really lucky. I mean, I had a theory, you know, that we were switching to this new program trading run by computers, that something like this much is really on the horizon and could happen. I didn't think it would happen to that extent, though. So trading is really glorified gambling. And I knew I'd probably give some of that money back to the market. And I hung out for another 2 years. Didn't do a lot, you know, of trading at that time, but was able to really leave the business at the peak of my career. And I looked great on the outside. I had built a house down in Mexico overlooking, you know, the Sea of Cortez. Mm-hmm. I had the fastest production car on the planet in the garage. I had no debt. And again, looking good on the outside. But in those years on Wall Street, very high stress business, I had started developing an addiction to cocaine, which was kind of the drug of choice of Wall Street back in those years. So, Kathleen, have you ever seen the movie The Wolf of Wall Street?
I have.
Well, I have not, because it's a little too close to home.
Got it.
But I have seen some of the trailers, and, you know, and in the trailers, you know, that was kind of a big part of that, you know, that whole storyline was the drugs that were involved in Wall Street back then, and it was a very enabling business, and it was a very well hidden, my addiction was very well hidden, because I wasn't showing any other signs of addiction other than, you know, that I was, you know, kind of disappearing on the weekends, and then, you know, and then I would, you know, stay out late on Thursdays, and pretty soon when I retired, every day was a weekend. So addiction does not remain the same over time, it gets worse.
And so as this progressed, where did you find yourself? Because I think this is the most startling part of your story.
Well, this is the power of addiction. So look at me at 29 years old, looking great, you know, all on the outside, and I'm really dying on the inside. And 4 years later, I've gone through every asset that I have through family relationships and friendships that I'd had my entire life. I'm totally isolated, and I'm living on the streets of Phoenix. So actually living homeless. As I say, I was living in a bush, not too far from downtown. And you were in the real estate business. You know, it's like, how do you, you know, pick an area? Well, you know, where you park, you know, to get out of the sun and the heat, you have to be by maybe places like St. Vincent de Paul, which is in Phoenix that feeds the homeless. You had to be by the court system. You had to be by legal services. And you had to be by public transportation. So, you know, my bush that I was living in, it's location, location, location. So, you know, because now I'm getting arrested for being homeless and ending up in our criminal justice system. And that was back in the Joe Arpaio days. And it was a, you know, it was a rough go of it when you went into Maricopa County Jail. That was a consequence. But I was being released the next day because I, you know, basically a misdemeanor. Homelessness had been criminalized. And so now I'm, you know, going to jail and getting released. But one thing that I noticed and probably most poignant in this part of my story is that I was being released with the same drug problem that I was arrested with.
Right.
Although in jail, I was being introduced to a lot of different people that were just like me. And so now I'm networking with other addicts and who's selling what where, you know, who are the dealers and who are actually the importers of narcotics into this country. So, you know, if I'm a user dealer, which many of our people that are dealing drugs, they're just supplying their own addiction through dealing, then I've just been introduced to somebody who's importing drugs, and I've just got rid of maybe 4 or 5 middlemen. So it was kind of a gladiator school on how to be a better drug addict.
So,
and there was no really solution to that.
So I just want to underline that. So being homeless, and going to prison, you were meeting other people that were drug users, drug pushers, drug traffickers, and you got smarter by going to jail, but no one was doing anything to treat the underlying cause of, number one, why you were homeless, and no one was giving you a plan on how to improve your life. They were just cycling you through in and out of the jail. Is that an accurate assessment of what
exactly
you said?
And really treating my addiction with incarceration or punishment. They're trying to punish my addiction out of me, which just makes me feel worse, which means I want to medicate the way I'm feeling. So my addiction actually increased and did not get better. So then my crime started as you become more and more desperate. I'm taking, you know, a narcotic that really robs me of my ability to care. Now let's plug that into the homeless encampments, is that when people are using drugs to the level of being addicted to drugs, meaning daily users of drugs, is it really affects the brain to the point where you are being robbed of your ability to care. People say, well, you know, there's showers available, they don't shower, or these encampments have trash everywhere. You're dealing with a population that is really being robbed of their ability to care. They don't care. And people that don't care can become dangerous very quickly also.
Yes.
So now my crimes are increasing into the felony realm, and that is I'm taking things that are not mine. I've become that which I abhor in our society, and I'd become a thief. And, you know, and I had conned my friends, and I had lied to them, and they'll feel sorry for me. And, you know, I need help, and I conned other people, and then I started taking things in our mind, which we call drug-motivated crime, a lot of property crime. Right. You know, people jumping over fences in your community to steal bikes and taking them to pawn shops, that's drug-motivated crime. So now I'm up in the felony realm, and now I get arrested in, actually up in Yavapai County in Prescott, and I had stolen from a girl that I was dating as I was on this downward spiral. She was actually also a cocaine addict and really had introduced me to freebasing cocaine, which is smoking cocaine, which is a very quick and downward spiral. Mm-hmm. And she was in school. Her parents knew that she had an addiction problem and gave me, because I, once again, was hiding my addiction, gave me her tuition money, and I stole the money and disappeared. That's felony. This was out-of-state tuition. I'll never forget. It was $2,760 that I stole, and that is well into the felony realm. And so now I'm being held onto. I'm not being let go. And while I was in that jail, I was diagnosed falsely, because I got very ill in that jail, and I was diagnosed and had a false positive for HIV, which back then was a 2 to 3 year, 100% fatal death sentence.
Right.
So that's bad news. You know, and I was delivered that news by the county sheriff. He had people there from the health department, a psychiatrist to help me through this, the jail commander and the jail chaplain, because I was basically just given a death sentence. And at the time, my plea agreement was not taking my case to trial. I was pleading guilty to this because, guess what, Kathleen? I was guilty.
Yeah.
And my plea agreement was 4 years in prison. So therefore, I was just told that I will never see freedom again, and I'm going to die a pretty horrible death in Arizona Department of Corrections. So that's a bad day. And I realized that everybody in the room cared more than I did.
Wow.
I remember looking around and people were visibly shaken, and I just didn't care. I remember back to the point of being robbed of my ability to care. So I asked them to take me back to my cell, and they said it's cell block, which is in with a bunch of other people. And they said, well, that's why the jail commander's here, is that we have to put you in solitary confinement because you now have a deadly bloodborne disease and we have to protect the inmate population from you. I remember thinking, how much lower in life can you get?
Right.
You know, you are a threat to the inmate population. So I was put into solitary confinement and no human contact. It's like you see in the movies. It's an iron door with a little slot where your food came through, and the room's not big, much bigger than your bed. And I was there away from all the distraction in the world, really. And, you know, something happened in there, Kathleen. You, I have discussed this before. It's very hard to describe, but I found that the best way to describe it is, you know, when you're a kid, all you want to do is feel loved and secure.
Right.
Now, I'm not trying to evangelize anybody, you know, on this call with you today, but I had a spiritual experience in there. And, you know, what I like to call God, and God, you know, really was in there with me. And I felt an overwhelming sense of love and that everything was going to be okay. I felt very secure. People say that must have been the worst time of your life. And it was really one of the best times of my life, because, as I like to say, it was just me and God in that cell, away from all the distractions that are out in the world.
So I'm going to take a break. And Jeff, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about from there what happened. And I am so grateful that we are here with Jeff Taylor talking about homelessness, substance abuse. I'm Kathleen Wynn. We'll be back right after this message. You are listening to me, Kathleen Wynn, on Wynn Tucson, where we will continue to talk issues, not politics. And my special guest today, Jeff Taylor, government relations professional. So, Jeff, you are in a jail cell. You are told that you're going to die, and you're all alone. And you discover faith and God. And so that's where we left, and we have a lot of ground to cover, so we're going to have to kind of, but I want to hear, this is, a pivotal point that brought you to the work that you currently do now. So please continue.
Yeah, so, you know, it was a false positive, as it turns out. Miracles started to occur. The HIV diagnosis turned out to be false. Obviously, I'm here today, and, you know, and this was a little over 20 years ago. And then another miracle happened. And so you have a judge, and the judge has a plea agreement in front of him, and judges almost always, you know, stay within the confines of that plea agreement. My plea agreement was 4, 5, or 6 years in the Arizona Department of Corrections for that theft charge supporting my drug habit. And the judge broke away from the plea agreement, made a deal with the prosecutor. He was able to identify that I was doing, like I said, drug-motivated crime, things that I would never dream of doing unless I was, you know, funding really an addiction. And he broke away and he sentenced me to a long-term treatment program run by the Salvation Army in Phoenix, Arizona. So I was sentenced to treatment. And that is the key, I think, for our discussion today, Kathleen, is I had a behavioral health problem. It was called drug addiction. It was being treated with incarceration up to this point, and now I have a pathway to recover through the Salvation Army. Salvation Army is a marvelous organization. Where can you get 6 months of residential drug treatment for free? Their programs are all free, and they never judged me. I'm feeling pretty low about myself, but given every gift God could give somebody, and I messed it all up, you know, in my, you know, my behaviors. I can't blame anybody for that. It was just all on me at that point. And I learned to be accountable. I learned to be honest about the things that I had done. And I learned really how to react differently to this world. The only thing that I have control over is how do I react to what's occurring. And you can react in an unhealthy way by masking it with, you know, different, you know, substances, alcohol or drugs or marijuana or whatever. Or I can deal with it head on and react in a positive way. So I graduated from the program, went back to school, and this marvelous life-changing program closes due to lack of funding. And I read in the paper that it's very expensive to run this facility, and it's all privately funded, by the way. Actually, the drug treatment centers are funded by the generosity of each community when they give donated items to be sold in Salvation Army thrift stores. 100% of that proceed goes to their drug treatment model. So we actually got up and went to work every day, you know, and we worked within either that system, which is, you know, in the warehouse or picking up furniture items from homes, things like that. But we earned that treatment bed. We were really taught a work ethic, and it's actually called a work therapy program.
So right now, though, we have empty treatment beds, do we not? So we still have a huge, huge homeless problem in Arizona, and we aren't treating our homeless. And you probably don't, I don't even know that this metric exists, but do we know of our homeless how many are addicted to drugs right now? Do we know what that, is it 50%? Is it 30%?
Well,
do we even know?
Again, when we're talking about, about the chronically homeless, which is what we're talking about today, not the families and not the elderly.
Right, okay? Exactly.
So the chronically homeless that are in encampments, we need to call it what it is. And that is what I said earlier. We need to call chronic homelessness what it is: untreated drug addiction, untreated mental illness, or some combination of both. So
it's a much higher
getting
number
treatment.
Than...
Oh, I would say it's upwards of 90%.
Okay.
And I tell this to many of the legislators that I work with, and I've told this directly to four different governors, is I have yet to meet someone who's chronically homeless that is not addicted to some substance, mentally ill, or some combination of both. So 20 years of dealing with this population, I have yet to meet somebody like in an encampment that is not one or both.
Jeff,
so now I graduate the program, and now I'm, you know, launched, and I noticed that we couldn't get funding for drug treatment, but guess what? The legislature appropriated in that year, I think it was $64 million to build bigger prisons.
Oh my gosh.
And that's where I was headed. And so here's a $64 million appropriation. Incidentally, Department of Corrections budget has only grown. When we went through our biggest budget crisis ever, which is from the, you know, subpar lending mortgage crash of 2008, 2009, 2010, every state budget, including education, which is very key to this conversation, education was decimated. We slashed education. We slashed Department of Economic Security. We cut Department of Child Safety. We cut all of which was Child Protective Services back then. And yet we gave more and more money to Department of Corrections. So again, we were managing our drug problem with incarceration. Only so people can go to prison, be untreated, and get out with the same drug problem they were arrested with. Only they picked up a lot of new skills, the same type of skills that I
and then they remained homeless
the
or
county jail.
And then they remain homeless or committing crimes.
Yeah, so we spend a lot of money in our correctional system making people worse. And that was really my message when I picked up that magazine article. Is I just went down. I didn't have a car then. I rode my bike down to the Arizona legislature, and I started meeting with members and just telling them what I thought was a solution. And let's fast forward today. I became a lobbyist. I mean, I don't know how to write legislation, but, you know, I used to pray a lot, Kathleen, as you know.
Yes.
And I was like, you know what, God, I don't know how to do this, but you do. And was able to write legislation and get sponsors for the bill and support and governor support to sign legislation that to this day has released 20,000, I think a little more than 20,000 inmates from our prison system early. We reward good behavior. They get out actually 90 days early
and get jobs,
as evidenced by their good behavior. And they are then placed into a behavioral health transitional program. And that means they're getting treatment for their mental illness, drug addiction, and they're also assigned a case manager that helps them get a job and also a safe place to live. And we have tons of data on this and how you really measure the success of any prison program is how much do you reduce recidivism? That means people going back, committing new crime in our community and going back. And this program has been in place now for about 18 years, and it has reduced recidivism by people that qualify for the program by over 60%. That means we have less crime in our community. We have former tax burdens because we're paying $24,000 a year for them to be incarcerated and turning them into taxpayers because they're employed and being launched as a responsible and self-sufficient member of our community. So it's been a tremendously successful program. And, you know, just so many miracles have occurred since then. Like now, I have several different clients as a lobbyist, all within the same field. And how do we plug this into our homeless problem? And
yes.
And what we have is I've traveled all over the Western United States. I've been to San Francisco. I've been to Oakland. I've been to California. I have not been up to Seattle yet, but I plan a visit there and also into Oregon. And I just got back from Honolulu, which really has a bad chronic homeless population there too. And I've also been to San Diego. And what these communities have confused is compassion with enabling. And what they're homeless to do whatever they want to do, and the law enforcement's hands have been tied, right. And therefore you have this population that is robbed of their ability to care, that is growing and growing and growing. And in my view, and in my opinion, we are prolonging human suffering by allowing the homeless to do what they do.
So, Jeff, in Pima County,
you're chronically homeless.
In Pima County, 15% of the state's total homelessness resides in Pima County. And so, because I appreciate all the work you're doing all over the western part of the United States. South Tucson is the poorest town in Arizona, and so we have Tucsonans in poverty. We have homelessness that's chronic. We have drug addicted encampments in Pima County, and is it because of what you just said? We're not treating the real issue, and we're trying to bring compassion to it, but we really need to provide treatment to our homeless. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, this is a solution, in my opinion. Now, probably going to get a lot of blowback from my
opinion. Here's what I'm going to have you save that solution, because we're heading into a break, and when we get back, I want to hear your solution. We're going to take a break. This is Kathleen Wynn with Wynn Tucson with my special guest Jeff Taylor, government relations professional, talking about drugs and homelessness. I'm Kathleen Wynn, and we're back on Wynn Tucson, where we're discussing issues, not politics, and my special guest Jeff Taylor. Jeff, so we're talking about your life and how you actually changed how we treated those that were chronically homeless, drug addicted. And it seems to me that the biggest turning point, there were many, but that you had an intelligent judge that understood what was happening there and gave you a sentence that pretty much changed the direction of your life and stopped the revolving door of going in and out of prison and not treating the underlying problem, which was the cause of your homelessness. So where should we go to judges right now? Should we look at sentencing as this next legislative session starts? What's going to be your highest priority, since we clearly have a homeless problem? It's growing in Arizona, the chronically homeless. What does 2023 look like for Jeff Taylor in this issue?
Well, we need to get the judges on board. We need to empower our police, because all three have to work together, and that is the judges, the criminal justice courts, and then also the treatment community. So even though that we have access to care right now, the people that are chronically homeless, and you can talk to any police officer, they offer treatment all the time, and they don't go. Addicts understand consequences. Now, I'm not outlawing or suggesting that we outlaw chronically homeless people, but we outlaw the behaviors that are occurring in these encampments. There is sexual assault on women.
Correct.
There is aggravated assault on each other. It's a very predatory environment where the mentally ill are targeted, the LGBT community is targeted, and it is, you know, really kind of a very abusive, what I call, we're prolonging that human suffering. It's gotten to the point where Phoenix Fire Department up here in Maricopa County, they won't go into a homeless encampment because they're so dangerous without a police escort. So I'm saying we outlaw the behaviors, the criminal behaviors of these individuals that have been really enabled to this point. So we need the judges to, we need to empower our police to start enforcing the laws and enforcing the laws of these assaults and these violent crimes and get them incarcerated. But not just, I don't want anybody just to be incarcerated because they have mental illness, but it's a starting point. There you can get people stabilized. There you can identify and assess people, because everybody's different. How far did you go in school? Did you, prior to your addiction, did you have skills? Are you employable? What's your family history with addiction? All of these are contributing factors on how to come up with a release plan. And the judges have got to stop releasing people overnight, because why would a police officer arrest somebody if they're back on the street the next day?
Well,
so we need... the judges to hold people on long enough in that jail to do a thorough assessment, come up with a release plan, and get them into the treatment that they really need.
The other thing I'm hearing from both police and fire, so I'll start with fire, is that they can't keep enough Narcan on board of the with paramedics, with fire, that they are constantly running out. So that tells me the severity of the drug problem. We've all heard about the fentanyl and the drugs pouring into our country. So,
Talk about fentanyl just for a moment.
Please.
Because it's a huge, huge contributing factor to our chronically homeless. So it all started, you know, back in the early 2000s with Vicodin, which was an opiate pain reliever. And then they came up with a timed release Vicodin opiate called OxyContin. And that OxyContin pill was, if it was being sold illegally, was about $60, $50 to $60 a pill. That equivalent in the fentanyl pill now is now $2 a pill.
Correct.
$2 a pill. So that is very affordable for the, so you can be a full-blown opiate addict on, you know, $30, you know, take more than one pill, depending on, you know, where you are in your addiction, $20, $30, $35. And that means that you can stand on a street corner with a sign and raise enough money to be a full-blown opiate addict and remain homeless. And we've got to stop this enabling behavior.
Correct.
Of just allowing people to do what they do, because maybe the crime has dropped off, but that doesn't mean that they're still not a dangerous person. People are withdrawing. And, well, they're nonviolent drug offenders. And I'm like, they're nonviolent until they are. There have been some horrific murders that have occurred. This is a danger to our community, and I want to help these people. I love the homeless. I talk to them all the time. I ask them their name, and I try to get them in the treatment, and they won't go. There has to be a consequences plus help. So that's what I'll be working on at the legislature this year, and we need to make it a safer community for all of us. There is still a lot of property crime going on. Some of our neighborhoods are and city parks are being overrun by the homeless, or children can't play there. There's needles in these parks. And it's an unsafe environment, you know, where kids don't have the ability to go to their city parks anymore.
Yeah, we have a progression. We have a progression that's happening in our communities that makes us. You said you've been to San Francisco, so we know in San Francisco there's needles everywhere, and it's a terrifying situation that we have with our children. It's not safe. We know that there's been an increase in violent crime, murders. All those types of crimes are up dramatically in the state of Arizona. And we can't lay that all on the feet of the chronically homeless. But unfortunately, while all these issues are happening, we're not treating this part of our population, and it's dramatically getting worse. What do we say to law enforcement? I mean, they don't seem to have enough resources. So do we put this on them? What do we do? How do we make this cohesive? I think it seems so segmented to me in terms of our leaders, then our law enforcement, our judges. How do we bring them together to have a cohesive plan? Because that seems to me what's missing right now.
And that's the hardest part, is how do we get the city, the county, the county, that would be the judges, the city is police department, so the city, the county, and then the criminal justice system to all work together. So that means, you know, we're not releasing people that are, you know, doing some pretty violent things, you know, and we're seeing how this pendulum has swung to where we're releasing people after a very violent act, even the day before. So we need to keep people in the jail long enough for them to get some nutrition, get their days and nights into nights to get clear of the drugs out of their system, and they become much more reasonable. Come up with a plan, do a thorough assessment. There's a great model in Yavapai County in Prescott run by the sheriff up there called the Reach Out Program that is proving to be extremely successful. They're dropping their homeless population in a county that's really growing, by the way. They're
yes.
dropping their homeless population. They're removing people from the criminal justice pathway. Where you start, that's the consequence. So once again, addicts understand consequences. So you start with criminal justice and, you know, having a consequence, empowering the police to enforce those laws, but not releasing them, so the police have to rearrest the same person over and over again. They're not going to do that. Who would? You know, their resources are stretched, to your point. So,
and our police know
and
the
then release the person.
Our police know the homeless. They know who's at what corner. They know who these people are. They're not unknown to our police departments, but they are a danger to themselves and to the community. And I think there has to be done more to support our law enforcement, and that's got to come from leadership. And we don't have that dynamic for sure down here in Pima County, and it's got to change. I want to just
talk about, you know, retail theft. You know, retail theft is through the roof, and most of the retail theft, I mean, I've been in, you know, in CVS pharmacies or in Target, and people just walk in and they just steal things and walk out. And mainly they're supplying, you know, we all pay for that. You know, that high theft charge is all passed down to us. So it's turned into a community of lawlessness, enabling the homeless population to just continue these types of behaviors, which gets worse over time. So, it takes a collaboration between the state, the city. The state needs to, you know, impose some legislation and laws that empower the police and also get the judges to start holding on to people long enough that they can clear up, and that we can deal with a person who is clear of the drugs and that have their lives back on some sort of stability. And that can be done in the jail system, you know, and the jail system needs to change in that, you know, whenever I went to jail, I was treated pretty poorly there. And, you know, we had a very expensive experiment in Joe Arpaio, and that is we're going to make our jail so tough that you're never going to come back. And I met with the sheriff and I told him, you know what, your jail was so tough, they only went back 6 times. That wasn't working.
Well, we'll leave that discussion for another day. We only have a few minutes left, and I just want to say that we didn't talk about it today, but it's a place where I have my heart, which is focused on victims of sexual assault, sex trafficking, And that is also very much a part of this. And I think maybe engage those advocates and those people, and we come together, because this problem is solvable. And it really affects the overall quality of life for everybody that we have in our state, and specifically now for us in Pima County. I want to thank you for giving us your time, for sharing your story. I have known you for a long time, and I am grateful for our friendship and for the continued work that you do with our legislators to make them aware that some solutions are complex. So I want to thank you, Jeff Taylor, for all the efforts that you bring to our state to make us safer, better, and thank you for our time. We will talk again. And I want to thank everyone else for joining us today on Win Tucson. I'm Kathleen Wynn, and we'll be back tomorrow.